Welcome to Defenders, Dr. William Lane Craig's weekly class at Johnson Ferry Baptist Church in Atlanta. For more information concerning the subjects on which Dr. Craig speaks, visit our website at reasonablefaith.org. You'll find articles, compelling debates, audio-video downloads, an interactive forum, and many more resources. That's reasonablefaith.org.
Right. Well, we want to turn now to the second half of this section on Doctrine of the Last Things. We've been looking at the return of Christ, and now we want to talk about the state of the soul after death. Man has a deep inner longing for immortality. There is something within us that senses that we should live forever, that death is unnatural, that it's wrong that self-conscious, personal beings should come to extinction. E.J. Carnell, in his classic book, An Introduction to Christian Apologetics, writes as follows: "Man appears to be literally suspended between heaven and earth, between the ideal and the real, between the desirable and the actual. He longs for a strong body, but the lethal germs cut short the hope. He prays for another day to live, but the scythe of death cuts him down. He trusts in marble monuments, only to have the earth beneath them buckle and crumble. Whatever man achieves, the universe seems determined that the weeds of time and indifference cover it over. Every cultural expression has the same verdict written over it. This is doomed to decay. What sense is there in such a universe, and who is responsible for this monstrous situation? The failure to be able to unite the real and the ideal presses home to man a strange, impelling sense of the futility and absurdity of life. There is no castle that man can build which will last forever, for regardless how deep the foundation, how thick the walls, how immense the superstructure, the same decree of decay is written over it, as is written over everything which man undertakes. The incongruity between man's desire for life and the reality of physical death is the most maddening problem of all. Although he sees the handwriting on the wall, yet man refuses to think that death is his final destiny, that he will perish as the fish and the fowl, and that his place will be remembered no more. Man wills to live forever. The urge is written deep within his nature." I think that's very true. We have a deep instinctual longing for the transcendent and for immortality. And this comes to expression in various ways in the world's religions. For example, in the book Basic Christian Doctrines, J.G.S.S. Thompson writes as follows: "He says, belief in survival after death is not only universal, but very ancient. The Egyptians held it. In Greece, it was adopted by the Orphics, from whom Plato received it. The Hebrews accepted it. Jews in Christ's day held it. Christianity has always believed it. And for primitive man, too, immortality was a certainty, not a conjecture. Survival after death was how man interpreted the ineradicable intuition rooted in the imperishable core of his being." So this longing for immortality is something that comes to expression in various ways in the world religions, whether reincarnation or life after death in a heaven or a hell or some such thing. There is this deep sense of longing for to live forever. And there are certain pointers, I think, in the world that point us to immortality, that give us hope of immortality. And let me mention three of these. First would be man's personality. We sense that we are persons, that is to say, a self-conscious I, that is a capital I, myself, me, the person that I know as a first person, a soul, a self, there is this self-consciousness that can never be objectified and turned into an it. The philosopher Feuerbach gave this exercise to his students in order to illustrate this point. He said, think about the wall. Now, think about him who thought about the wall. Now, think about him who thought about him who thought about the wall. And you see, what the point of the exercise is, there's always this unobjectifiable self that is doing the thinking, even when you think about yourself. You don't fully objectify yourself. When I think about me, there is this person that is thinking about me. And this is what philosophers have called the transcendental ego, this self that cannot ever be objectified because it is always the thing that is doing the thinking about the object. So there is this person, this transcendental ego, and this self that seems to transcend mere physical organs. I have the sense that I am not identical with my body. My body changes. I can have a complete transformation of all of the molecules of my body, and yet I remain the same person. And so this gives some suggestion that there is this immaterial self that is distinct from the body that could well outlive the body and be immortal. Not a proof, but at least some sort of a pointer to immortality. Another pointer to immortality would be man's rationality. Our minds, that is our conscious life, and our bodies are obviously interdependent. On the one hand, I can will to do things, like to lift my arm, and my arm goes up, or I can will to take a step, and I walk. There seems to be a control of my body through my mind. And yet, on the other hand, the mind is obviously affected by the body. Someone who receives a severe injury to the head will be knocked unconscious, or perhaps even suffer mental illness or derangement or personality disorder because of the brain injury that he sustains, so that the body has an effect upon the brain as well. Now, there are three possibilities as to how the mind and the body interrelate. One would be that it is purely a one-way street from the body to the mind, that the mind has no effect upon the body. The mind is just a sort of excrescence or a sort of floating, hovering phenomenon that is produced by the brain when it functions. Kind of as the brain functions chemically, the mind is just sort of the offshoot of this. But the mind has no impact upon the brain itself. That would be one way. The other alternative, one of the other alternatives would be saying, no, the mind just influences the body. The mind controls the body and has complete reign over it. And in that way, the body would have no effect upon the mind. Well, that seems obviously false, because we know that when things go wrong bodily, our minds are affected. Drunkenness or drugs and things of that sort affect our thinking. And the third alternative would be that the mind and the body mutually influence each other. That is to say, that the mind and the body cooperate together in thought. I once heard the great Nobel Prize-winning neurologist Sir John Eccles lecture on the relationship between the mind and the brain. And he said that the mind and the brain are like a pianist and his piano. In order to produce music, the musician or the pianist must have a finely tuned piano, and then he can produce the music. But if the piano is out of tune, even though the musician knows how to play the piece correctly, the music will be discordant, and he will not be able to produce the beautiful music. And similarly, Eccles said, the mind and the brain work together to produce thought. And if the brain is malfunctioning or injured or impaired, then thought will be impaired. The soul will not be able to think properly. Its instrument will be impaired, and so it cannot think correctly. Now, of these alternatives, only the first one would be incompatible with immortality. That would be just a physicalism, that we are just physical organisms, so that when the brain dies, the soul dies, the mind dies as well and disappears. But the other two would be quite compatible with immortality. And in fact, I think problematic with the first one is that it makes it impossible to make sense of things like personal identity over time, because if the mind is just this sort of phenomenon, this effervescence of the brain, then there really isn't any enduring person who goes from one moment to another. You're not the same person that walked in here, any more than the flame that is on a candle is the same flame that was on the candle a moment ago when it was burning. The flame is continuous, but it's constantly changing. This is, in fact, a Buddhist view of the self, not an enduring person, and yet surely we are the same people, the same persons that we are when we walked in. Also, freedom of the will is impossible on this physicalist view. If the influence of the brain and the mind is a one-way street, then the mind has no influence upon the brain. This leads to complete determinism. Everything you do is just the product of genetic makeup and sensory stimulation, so that nothing you do has any rationality or any freedom to it. And so that even the decision to believe in determinism would become irrational. It would just be something you're determined to do. But it wouldn't be a rational decision on your part to believe in determinism. It's therefore a kind of self-defeating worldview. You cannot rationally adopt it, because if you adopt it, you have to think that your believing it was itself an irrational, physically determined process. And the whole idea of intentionality, of having thoughts about something. For example, I can think about President Bush right now, or I can think about Dick Cheney, or I can think about my trip later in the week. Physical objects don't have intentionality. This podium, the book, the brain even, doesn't have this aboutness. Physical objects don't have intentionality about something. So, again, this would suggest that this first view is really inadequate. There needs to be some sort of an immaterial self, which we call the soul or the mind, which is distinct from the body. And this, again, would be a pointer to immortality, because this would be compatible with the survival of the soul, even if the body dies. Third point would be man's morality. Morality is radically undermined without immortality. If there is no immortality, then ultimately our fate is unrelated to our behavior. Whether we live as a Mother Teresa or as a Stalin, we all wind up the same. So that even if there are objective values and objective moral duties that we have, if there is no immortality, morality becomes a charade, because it's ultimately unrelated to our final fate. It becomes empty and meaningless. It becomes futile. No matter what you do, you just wind up the same. And so the great Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky said, "If there is no immortality, then all things are permitted." If there is no immortality, all things are permitted. That is to say, there's no moral accountability. What do you say to someone who says that he's just going to live for pleasure out of pure self-interest? You could say to him, well, you should do these things, and that would be right. Yes, morally he should do those things, but why should he adopt the moral point of view? The problem is that without immortality, prudential value and moral value can come apart. Morally, you should do something, but prudentially, it wouldn't be in your best self-interest to do that. You shouldn't adopt the moral point of view. It would be imprudent to do so because it might involve self-sacrifice or jeopardize your own life. So that on the view that there is no immortality, prudence, prudential value, and moral value fall apart, and this results in this discord, this sort of absurdity that Carnell talked about, where life is out of joint, so to speak, and our moral values tell us to do one thing, but our prudential values tell us to do something else. And so without immortality, morality, I think, is radically undermined and vacated of ultimate significance. But of course, people cannot live that way. Even a nihilist like Friedrich Nietzsche, in the end, could not live beyond good and evil, as he claimed the Superman should do. He said the Superman, the man who has realized that God is dead, will live beyond good and evil, beyond moral values. But even Nietzsche himself couldn't do that. Late in his life, he broke relations with his mentor, the opera composer Richard Wagner, because of Wagner's strident German nationalism and anti-Semitism, which Nietzsche disagreed with. Even Nietzsche couldn't live as though there were no objective moral values and duties. So that if there is morality, if morality is to be significant and meaningful, this again requires immortality. And the philosopher Immanuel Kant saw this point clearly. Kant was a 18th century German philosopher who believed that moral reason requires the existence of God as a postulate. In order for moral reason to be successful, he said, there must be a God and immortality in order to proportion happiness to virtue, because in this life, virtue and happiness are not proportionate. As I said, they're out of joint. The wicked often prosper, the righteous suffer and die in this life. And in order for virtue and happiness to be proportioned to each other, Kant said, there must be these postulates of immortality of the soul and the existence of God, who in the afterlife will apportion virtue to happiness. So while these aren't proofs for immortality, I think that man's personality, rationality, and morality all give us pointers, as it were, or signposts of immortality that provide hope. Now, before we look at the biblical position on immortality, let me ask if there's any comment or question that anybody has. Amy. Okay, what was Kant's basis for saying that there should be proportionality between happiness and virtue? I'm not sure how to answer that question. Probably, I'm guessing here now, but he would probably say that virtue ought to be rewarded, that the very nature of virtue is something that it ought to have some kind of a recompense, whereas someone who has done wicked ought to be punished. And that seems to me to be right, that virtue deserves reward, punishment deserves, or rather evil deserves punishment. And if there is no immortality, this fundamental ought goes unsatisfied. So I suspect that that would be the lines along which Kant would argue, though I couldn't point you to a specific passage in his writings where he does argue that way. Well, yeah, I appreciate that, though I think that if you reflect on what I just said, isn't it correct, though, that, for example, evil deserves punishment? If there is objective morality in the world, the very nature of evil is that it deserves punishment. Justice isn't satisfied unless it's punished, and goodness deserves reward. So I think that there is this fundamental moral ought. I mean, we're assuming here that morality is objective, that morality really exists. If it really exists, it would seem to me that immortality would be required, given that in this life, justice and isn't done. So I don't think it's just wishful thinking. It would be more that morality, if it is to be satisfied, if there is to be this objective ought, and if that's to be fulfilled, then you need to have immortality as a precondition. Now, he didn't think this was a proof. He called it just a postulate. So maybe in that sense he would agree with you. It's not a proof, it's a postulate, a requirement of the meaningfulness of the moral life. And I think that's right. That seems to me correct. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. All right. Let's understand what the question is. The question he asks is, how would you respond to people who deny that there is any objective morality? Now, as I was saying to Amy, what I'm assuming here is that there is objective morality, and just saying that in order to be meaningful and significant, morality requires immortality. Now, that's quite consistent with saying that there is no objective morality. This is conditional. It is, if there is objective morality, then there needs to be immortality as well. Do you see that point, that I'm arguing this conditional? But now you're asking the deeper question is, well, why think there is objective morality? It's very interesting that students tend to be relativistic and think that their professors believe relativism. But if you were to do a survey, as has been done, of university professors, you would actually find that university professors believe more in the existence of objective moral values than students do, and that of the professors, it is the philosophy professors who believe in objective morality more than their colleagues do. Now, why is that? Well, I think it's because moral philosophers reflect upon our moral experience, and in our moral experience, we sense certain moral obligations, this moral oughtness that I talked about, that I ought to do this, I ought not to do that. We also sense that there are certain things that are objectively good and objectively evil, that it really is wrong to torture a child for fun, that's an objective moral value. And any argument for moral relativism or nihilism will have premises in it that will be less certain than that moral experience itself, and therefore they consider themselves to be justified in going with their moral experience. So that's the basic answer, is that any argument for relativism will have in it somewhere a premise or premises which are less warranted than the warrant that we have for our moral values and duties that we apprehend in moral experience. And that's why, for example, last week at my debate at the University of Massachusetts with the atheist philosopher Louise Anthony, she held firmly to objective moral values and duties. She believes slavery is wrong, that torture is wrong. Why? Well, because she says any argument for relativism will be less certain than my own moral apprehension of these values and duties and moral experience. Yes? Well, that's correct. Take a look at somebody like Richard Dawkins, for example, in his book, The God Delusion. He denounces God as a foundation for moral value and claims that there is no good, there is no evil. And yet, he turns around and denounces things like religious intolerance, indoctrination of children in the church, the Amish raising their children in these backward communities. He even proposes a Ten Commandments of his own to regulate society. So it's very clear that someone like Dawkins cannot live consistently with his moral nihilism. He gives lip service to it, but then when you look at the way he really lives and writes, he affirms moral values left and right. He's an indelibly stained moral realist, in fact. Yes, you had a comment, I think. Yeah. Well, I would say the question was, what would you say to someone who says that moral values are just the result of socio-biological conditioning? I would say that that is absolutely correct if there is no God. On atheism, that seems to me to be the correct account of moral values, that they are just patterns of behavior ingrained into us through biological evolution and societal and parental conditioning. But if there is a God, then he would be the objective foundation of moral values and duties. And no matter how influenced we were by our evolutionary background or our societal conditioning, nevertheless, that would be just the way we come to discover moral values. It wouldn't be the basis for moral values. So the whole question really comes down to whether or not you believe there is a transcendent God to serve as the foundation for these moral values. But I would agree with them that if there is no God, then he's right. That is all that moral values are. And the point that I'm making here is that if there is objective morality, as most people think, including atheists, then immortality is a precondition of that morality's being significant and meaningful. Otherwise, it becomes futile. Okay, George, I think this will be our last question. Yeah. Yeah, good point that George is making. The problem that Kant found himself in was that he didn't think that there were sound arguments for God's existence. And even this moral position we've just described isn't an argument for God, as I said to Amy. God is simply postulated as a precondition for morality being significant. But, as George says, if you reject Kant's restriction of the categories of the mind to just sense experience, if you say that the mind can also grasp things beyond the five senses, and I think the mind obviously can, then there's no reason that the mind cannot provide arguments for God's existence. And in fact, I think that this then becomes a good moral argument for the existence of God, that given our apprehension of objective moral values and duties, it would follow that God exists as the ground and foundation for those. And so this is an argument I use all the time in my debates with atheists and agnostics. I think it does give good moral grounds. So George is right to point out that the weakness of Kant's position here that Amy pointed out is a result of Kant's prior commitment to saying that there are no sound theoretical arguments for God. Okay, well, next time what we'll do is begin to look at the biblical data in the Old Testament concerning immortality of the soul.
For more resources from Dr. William Lane Craig, visit our website at reasonablefaith.org. You'll find articles, debates, audio video downloads, and much more. That's reasonablefaith.org. The copyright for this material is owned by Dr. William Lane Craig.